morning to everybody. We're just about to start our class. Today we're digressing from Kohelis, and we will be taking up the account of Bilam and the talking donkey. We'll be reading that in a few weeks coming up on Shabbos, but I thought that would be very interesting to the group. So we'll start in just about 1 minute. And that can be found in Numbers chapter 22. Some time during the class for any questions or comments. If you're joining us online, you can type those in. Otherwise, I'll pause as we do the class. Those of you on the phone can make your comments or suggest answers to the questions that we'll have. And again, we'll start just in about a few seconds. Hello.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Doug. How are you today?
Good morning, Rabbi.
Hi, Rivka. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Very good. Looking forward to the class.
Okay, thank you. So everybody had a chance to take a look at the Torah section?
Mm-hmm. Just looking at it now.
So we mentioned what we're going to do today is take up the story of Bilam and the donkey. That was very interesting. So many profound lessons here. Just really robust with insight, and there's so many examples in the verses as we'll go through it that you'll see how crafted this story is, how well crafted it is in terms of such, you know, the amount of ideas and the method by which God reveals the ideas by subtle cues in the verses. So for background, what was going on at the beginning of this section, which is Numbers 22 right at the beginning, was that Balak was a king of Moab, the country of Moab, and he saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And he was concerned because of the people. They're very numerous, and now they were heading towards his country. So Balak was concerned about this, and he had a concern about the fact that they were, since there were so many, it would have an effect agriculturally in terms of whatever they would eat. You see, he equated it, like, for example, he says in verse chapter 22, or it says verse 4. He said, now they'll look up this nation his congregation will lick up the boundaries like an ox eats up the herbs of the field. So he sent messengers out to Bilam. Bilam was now known to be able to curse, which is an interesting phenomenon. And he sent out, so Balak sent out messengers. He says he figured this would be a way to succeed over the Jews. If it can't do it by numbers, we'll do it through some sort of a, you know, a divination, a practice, a heathen practice, of course. So he sends the messengers out, and he says in verse 6 that they should curse for me this people, because they're very mighty, and they're greater than me. Perhaps I'll be able to smite them and drive them out of the land. Because I know whoever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed. That was a message that the king Balak sent to Bilam, the prophet.
Rabbi?
Yes?
So do we know from the sages or other sources whether that ability to curse was a true ability or just perceived because of some coincidental things that had happened and he gained a reputation?
It's very good that you mention that. The Rabbi Chay gave a beautiful class on that, which he stated the latter. A person has no ability to curse. Only God can alter nature. Man can alter what he can in terms of whatever is his muscular power or his technological ingenuity. But to verbalize something and that words would have an effect, that's not something which is a truism. It's not a true idea. So what Rabbi Chay explained was that he ostensibly had cursed, meaning that Bilam had very good insight, and he was able to see when somebody was on his rise or somebody was now going to fall. And right before that happened, he would pronounce either a blessing or a curse, and it would seem to the onlooker that the rise or fall was due to Bilam's words. But it was not, of course. He just was able to harness the opportunity to make himself look like he had this type of ability. All right?
That's good. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a very, very good, very, you know, he gave his whole class on that. Yeah, just to sum up exactly, just to answer you. Okay. So now, so the messengers come, and they bring the message to Bilam. So he says, stay the night, and I'll give you a response back from God. So he seems like a good guy. But we'll see that this is not so. So God tells him not to go with him. Not to go with the messages. He tells him in the vision of the night, you cannot go with these men. And he gives him responses, I can't go with you. Okay. So that's verse 10. And God says in 12, you cannot go with them because they're blessed. These people are blessed. So he gives them a response. He now talks back and he tells them that go back to your land because God has prevented me. This is in verse 13. So they went back to Balak. And now Balak sends more honored messengers. Evidently, he thought there was like some sort of a egotistical thing, so he felt that they weren't significant enough for him to respond in Bilam's mind. So Balak and Bilam are both politicians, and Balak sent even more honored princes and gave the request again to come and curse these Jews so he can overtake them. So Balak says back that even if you filled my house with silver and with gold, I cannot transgress the word of my God to do anything small or great. But then he says to them, stay the night and I'll see what God might add. So you see now a little bit of an opening in terms of Bilam's attitude. Even though he was told already not to curse, the second request, he sought again an opportunity to curse the Jews. So this time God allowed him to go. We're not going to get into why. And he says now, it says in verse 21 that Bilam got up in the morning early, and he saddled his donkey, and he went with the officers of Moab, the Moabite officers. And this angered God. So now what did God do? Here comes the whole story, which is an amazing story. God stood an angel of God in the path to turn him aside, to turn Bilam aside. And he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. Now you should take note, almost every detail here is a new point. Okay. And it says in verse 23 that the donkey saw the angel of God standing in the path, and his sword was outstretched. And the donkey turned aside from the path, and it went into the field. And Bilam smote the donkey to get it back on the path. Then the angel of God stood again in the vineyards, where there was a fence on both sides of where he was walking. And the donkey again saw the angel of God, and it pressed up against the wall, and it crushed Bilam's leg against the wall. And Bilam continued to hit the donkey. And then the angel of God again passed once again and stood in a very narrow place where there was no place this time to turn right or left. And the donkey saw the angel of God, and it crouched down, it collapsed underneath Bilam, and Bilam's anger burnt, and he hit the donkey with a stick. And God opened the mouth of the donkey, and it said to Bilam, "What have I done to you that you have hit me these three times?" And Bilam said back to the donkey, "Because you have mocked me. Would it be that I had a sword in my hand, I would slay you." And the donkey said back to Bilam, "Am I not the donkey which you rode upon from old until this day? Is it my way to do such to you?" And Bilam says, "No, it is not." Then God opened up Bilam's eyes, and he saw the angel of God standing in the way, and his sword was outstretched. So he bowed down to it, faceward, down to the ground. And the angel of God said, "What have you hit your donkey these three times? I have come out to turn you aside, because your way is against mine." And your donkey saw, and it turned aside these three times. Right. How does it translate today? You have the English there, Doug?
Yes, I have it.
Yes, we have probably several between us.
Okay, so it says in 33 that the donkey saw. Take that verse. Let's just read that carefully.
I'm sorry,
you
said 20. Go ahead, Rivka.
Yeah, did you want, Rabbi, did you want us to read it out loud or twice?
Yeah, read out loud 33.
Okay, I'm sorry, Doug, I didn't understand. Okay, the she-donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. Had it not turned away from me, I would now even have killed you and let it live.
So it says if it had turned aside or it hadn't?
If it had not turned away from me, I would now even have killed you and let it live.
Right, so that means to say that the donkey was now dead, according to Ibn Ezra. I would have let it live means the donkey, you see the last two words? Osohechiesi. I would have let the donkey live. That means that, reading Ibn Ezra says that it teaches that once the donkey spoke, it died. It doesn't say it died because he killed it. Right? Because you see that Bilam was talking to the donkey, and then he finally agreed. The donkey said in the end of verse 30, "Is it my way to treat you this way?" And Bilam says, "No." So, there's no more hitting of the donkey at that point. So why is it dead now? All right, interesting question.
Rabbi, is it not possible that the angel is saying, we've got an if clause, and the if clause is, had it not turned away from me, he's speaking conditionally, the angel speaking conditionally, I would have killed you, but let it live. In other words, you're both still alive, but I would have killed you, but I would have let it live.
Ibn Ezra's saying it's dead.
Interesting.
My translation says, had it not turned away from me, I would now even have killed you and let it live, which implies that the donkey's dead.
Right, exactly. But what's the significance of that is the question.
That's what I have as well.
Wow.
I read this previously. I just didn't get it last time when I read it.
All right, so it's basically saying that had the donkey not turned aside, you would have been killed. That means if you continued on your way and you didn't have the donkey turning away, but you continued on your path without the interruption of the donkey turning aside, then Bilam would have been killed and the donkey would have been let live. But now the opposite is the case because it did turn aside. So somehow that's spared Bilam, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what we get from that.
Right. That's
okay.
Seems to be.
All right, that's really the story. What I want to do is now is bring out, what are the questions? You tell me.
Rabbi, I have a question back on verse 20. Let's see, a little earlier. Verse 20.
Yeah.
And it said, Hashem came to Bilam that night and said to him, if the men came to summon you, arise and go with them, but only the thing that I shall speak to you, that shall you do. And then you jump ahead to 22, and it says, God's wrath flared because he was going. Well, God told him to go, so why would God be angry about that?
All right. Evidently, the problem was, if there was any gain, I think one of the commentaries say that if you're going, there's going to be some gain to you, so then go. But that wasn't his intent. His intent wasn't just a game. The intent seemed to be corrupt. Because God said that they're blessed, so you cannot curse them. Bilam still now wanted to go for the sake of cursing, so that's why he was in violation of God.
No.
And of course there's the question of why he, if he was such a wicked person, why did he have prophecy?
Right.
Separate question we're not going to go into, but the fact is that he did have, there was clearly...
It seems like this isn't the first time that he's had a relationship with God, because that was the first thing he said to Balak was, I need to go consult with Hashem, in the sense of him demonstrating that that is who he gets his... knowledge from, or what he should do.
Right. But evidently, even if God tells him don't curse, then second night he wanted to
Rabbi,
ask God again if he can curse.
May I ask a question?
Yes. Yes. Rivka? We lost her. Okay.
Rabbi, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. You here?
Yeah.
Hello?
Hmm. Well, that's weird.
That's funny.
We lost him.
Hello?
Maybe,
Hang on just a second. Let me see if I can get him back on.
Yeah. All right, since we have a technical difficulty for 1 second, we'll just call right back in. Yeah, it looks like we had a little interruption on the connectivity.
Oh, okay.
There you are. Thank you.
Yeah, the...
You might be thinking, and then, or I did.
No, I think the internet or something, we have the phone lines here and the internet are all one thing. And I was just noticing that the internet went down momentarily. So that's why we lost the phone signal.
Okay,
so Rivka, you had a question. I heard you asking.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Now, Balaam is the son of Beor. So he really wasn't, really a man of God. And certainly, Balak was from Moab, so he really wasn't with Hashem either. So they were both, in other words, they were both sort of on the same wavelength as far as trying to get rid of whatever they wanted, the situation they wanted to curse the Jews.
Correct.
But Balaam somehow, he turned around because the angel came to deal with him.
Well, that's what we're going to do, is try to understand what this whole story is about.
What does it mean?
That's what we're going to try to do. Hello?
So Balaam was the kind of person who was more, you would say, more obedient to God? Would you say that?
No. Again, we'll have to analyze the story first and see.
Okay.
Let's just take a look and see. But it seems to be clearly that the fact that he wanted to curse the Jews even after God says don't, the second time, that shows that he was not obedient to God. That was just his facade.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, it says that, and God openly says he's angry with him, so he can't be following God. God's angry with him. Okay?
Okay. Good point.
So now let's try to understand a number of things here. What other problems are there? Just from the verses that from the point that he goes with his donkey and he starts traveling on the way, and the whole incident with the angel. You tell me what the questions are.
Well, I'd be tempted to first ask, what's the angel all about in the first place, and why is it holding a sword in its hand?
Good. Okay.
Then what's the business about pressing Balaam's leg against the wall?
Good. That's actually how we got. Remember last week we were talking about Jacob wrestling with the man, and he hurt his leg and he was limping the next day. And that's how we actually got to decide to do it this week. Was because of that. That's a significant question. I agree.
Right. Then of course we have the whole issue of a talking donkey, and the fact that Balaam never acknowledges that he's talking to his donkey, which. If anyone started talking to their donkey, or the donkey started talking to them, they would at least be taken aback by that. Yet, Balaam just continues on like he does this every day.
Exactly. That struck me, too, as being very significant. And I think that's really where the opening is, in terms of trying to understand whether this is a literal account or not. I would say from that, that the person just starts talking back. Maybe in a dream you might do that, but awake, conscious, an animal starts talking to you, you don't just talk back as if nothing happened. And that's exactly what he did. And now it seems to signify that this is not something which is taking place physically. I mean, it's some sort of a internal event. You know, we'll have to see what we mean by eternal. You also have other a small piece of information, not small in importance, but it just says something just very briefly and then goes on. For example, why are we told that when in verse 22 God was angry that he went, and that the angel of God came out to turn him aside, and he was riding on his donkey and his two servants were with him? Sounds like superfluous information. He's riding on the donkey, there's two servants with him.
And if I recall, those two young men are never mentioned again, are they?
No.
That's right. That's true.
Right. Also very significant, in 23, what's very significant there?
Well, the fact that the she-donkey turned away and went out into the field.
That doesn't bother me so much. Why did it turn away?
Well, it saw the angel, but Balaam didn't.
Ah. Why? His eyes were open. He could see his donkey. Why can't he see what's down the road?
Right.
Again, this is something which should point you to the fact that this can't be taking place physically. Meaning, if your eyes are open and you can see a donkey, that means your sight is fine. So how come you can't see the God's angel? Right?
Right.
So I'm just trying to show you how you can start seeing the clues that indicate where you have to be looking for the understanding of such a story. It also says three times, it turned aside three times. It says that not only does it say it, where is it the first time? It's in 28. When the donkey says, what have I done that you have hit me these three times? Okay. And then in 32, the angel says to Balaam, why have you hit your donkey three times? What is it? What is so significant that it has to repeat that? And you'll see that the rabbis say, why three? Because he was out to curse the nation that celebrated the three holidays of Passover, Tabernacles, and Shavuos. Another commentary in Rashi, I didn't look at it, but the notes here. Three represents the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So what is meant by that? Well, what seems very odd. Okay? So you note that, the thing about three times.
David being struck for each of the patriarchs, and it is out of respect for them.
Well, wait, that's arbitrary. It doesn't... What does that have to do with this? It just doesn't seem to fit.
It doesn't say it outwardly, but it's alluding to it, I'm thinking.
Well, I mean, that's an arbitrary... I could say, the three holidays, too. But what does that mean? It seems arbitrary. Just because I have the number three, to find something that parallels three in Judaism, why don't I say it's the first three children of Jacob? I mean, there has to be an explanation. It can't just be a numerical correlation without an idea behind it.
Rabbi, what was
I thought you meant that it was written somewhere.
Well, Rashi says it, but what does it mean? Rashi does say it's the three patriarchs or it's the three holidays. That's what it means that he hit the donkey three times, but it seems to be completely unrelated. Doug, you had a question?
Oh, just what were the three holidays again?
Passover, Sukkot, Tabernacles, and Shavuos, receiving the Torah. The three holidays that we have.
So I would also ask, why those particular three? Because there are other Jewish holidays too.
Yeah, but they aren't considered the Regulam. They aren't considered, they have a unique status.
Oh, okay. That's an understood fact.
Yeah, that's an understood fact that there's a series. They really, as Rabbi Chait explained years ago, Passover is the exodus from the wrong ideology of Egypt. And Shavuos is the receipt of the right ideas. And Sukkot, Tabernacles, is the living of those ideas, putting it into action. So those three are really one set.
Okay.
And they also have to do with God's intervention. The God intervenes on those three. Those three all represent the idea of God's intervention. He rendered all the miracles in Egypt that caused our exodus. So his very providence caused our exodus, and then the Torah itself is, providence par excellence. That's God actually giving us the Torah. And then living in the tabernacle, so we were protected. So his involvement. And then also that's embodied by the the tabernacles that they lived in, leaving Egypt, going to Mount Sinai. And what we do on those three holidays is that we have a law in the Torah that we are supposed to go to Jerusalem, the pilgrimage. And we're supposed to go to the temple, meaning to embody the concept of the relationship. The temple meaning the idea of God's providence and involvement in the life of our lives. So it's a reiteration of that very providential relationship that we have with God, or that we should say that God has with us. So that providence, which was expressed in those three events, we embody that by going to the temple on those three holidays. So, see, providence is really the issue there. The three holidays, if we had to define them, they represent God's providence with the Jew. But then we have to understand also, what's the other Rashi about the three patriarchs? Why is that correlated over here to the three times you had to hit the donkey? Right? Okay. Then, of course, right, your question about why his leg was crushed against the wall. And it says interesting that the Malach then, the angel in 26, it says that the angel stood a third time in a place that was narrow, and he couldn't turn right or left. What's significant? What's so important about that? And now he takes out, the donkey just can't move any further. That's another significant thing. Why couldn't it move any further? It just crouched down. So go backwards. No, at this point, it just crouched down, it collapsed, and now it says that Bilam hit it with a stick. You see that at the end of 27?
Yeah.
And I believe Ibn Ezra is the one who says that each time he hit it, he used a bigger and bigger object. Each time he hit the donkey, he had to use a bigger and bigger object. Okay. So, if we had to line up who the characters are in this story, we basically have Bilam, we have the angel of God, and we have the donkey. We have the donkey, it talks, and it's not something which alerts Bilam at all, which is very strange. All right, we said that another point indicates that this is not a physical event is that Bilam can't see the angel, but the donkey can. And we also said in the beginning of the story in 22 that he's riding on the donkey, and his two servants are with him. What's the significance there? What do I need to know this? So there's a number of things going on, but we see there are three characters, and we see that Bilam is oblivious to one character, and the donkey does see it. And this thing about a talking donkey, what is the significance here? What is this thing? If it's not a physical event, that means these allude to something else. And that's really what our job is going to be, is to try to understand. So we think for a moment. We see right at the outset that God tells Bilam not to curse the Jews because they're blessed. Yet, the second time the messengers come, Bilam again tries to see if he can get God to his side so he can curse the Jews. So Bilam is bent on cursing the Jews. That's a clear thing from the story. And God even says to go, like Cal, you pointed out. And then when he does go, then all of a sudden God's angry. It's as if he changed his mind. No, we said that he went because not for any monetary gain, which God said, if you're going to go and there's going to be some gain to you, so then fine. But that's not why he went. He went now because he was still bent on cursing the Jews. And you see later on that he tried to, but it was successful. So what can you say about Bilam's state of mind and what might be going on over here in terms of the story?
Well, it seems like, Bilam has a clear psychological agenda. I mean, he wants to curse the Jews, so he's got some internal motivation beyond what seems like what Balak is suggesting.
Okay, and what's if we're saying that this is not the physical event? I mean, he could have been riding on a donkey to get to Balak in reality, but this whole story over here is not. The donkey wasn't talking. There was no his. In reality, the donkey didn't talk. This is now something which is taking place in his mind. So how can we construe what exactly, with all these different hints that we have about the three times and the donkey speaking and that he's riding on the donkey sees this angel of God, but Balaam doesn't. Look at that possibly.
The idea that when it says that Balaam can't see what the donkey sees, I wonder if that's indicative of how when we try to control, when people try to control something that's not in alignment, their vision is clouded. They cannot see reality, and the donkey was seeing reality.
Very good. So now, that means that it's something that's part of really Balaam. He doesn't see it. His vision of reality is clouded. And reality would be represented by what in this story?
The donkey.
Well, the donkey sees something that Balaam doesn't see. What does the donkey see?
The angel of the sword.
Right, the angel of the sword. So the angel of the sword is reality. I mean, a sword was a sword. A sword is something which is very real, very threatening. And the angel of God always represents truth. What's real. So that means to say that Balaam could not see reality, but his donkey could see it. What is the donkey then? And once we answer this, we'll be able to answer all other questions.
It wouldn't be his intellect, would it?
No.
I mean, we're saying it's some part of him that is able to see reality.
Right.
It seems like with Balaam riding on the donkey, he's in a more dominant position, and so it's a part of his personality that's dominating reality. His ability to see reality.
Right, he's dominating. That's the writing. Very good. So he's on something. He's controlling something. And he keeps on hitting that thing. And he has to keep on hitting it with a bigger and bigger stick. And as he keeps on progressing on this quote-unquote path, it's more difficult to avoid the angel, right? It gets to the point where they can't even turn left or right. And then the donkey just crouches down. And then, all of a sudden, it speaks.
It's like he's being forced to see reality, even though it's against his own will.
Right.
That's what I was thinking, too. Right. Very good.
Right. So what is the donkey, really? The donkey, to really, the Balaam in this story represents his instinctual drive. He just wants to do one thing. Let's curse the Jews. However, there's a conflict. God told them that they're blessed. But he still goes. He still goes in the path. He gets up in the morning, he saddles his donkey, and he goes. What does he do? It's interesting that it says by Abraham, where he also got up in the morning. And Rashi even compares this getting up in the morning by Balaam to Abraham. And it says that Balaam, the righteous Abraham, already preceded you. He got up early to sacrifice his son. You're getting up early to curse the Jews. But I think what's interesting over there is, let me see where the story is. Yeah, very, very interesting. You're going to love this. In Genesis 21:3, Abraham got up in the morning, and he saddled his donkey, and he took his two servants with him.
Wow, interesting.
What does it say over here? It says that Bilam got up in the morning, he saddled his donkey, and there went with him his two... he went to the officers of Moab, and God was angry that he went, and he stood the angel of God in the way. So he turned him aside, and he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. His two servants.
Interesting.
Okay. So, what are the two servants? Both cases.
I want to say that his two servants were his intellect and his emotions.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yes. Yes.
In both cases.
I was going to say his. He had like a confusion which way to go, and possibly that he was deciding. He was trying to decide should he or shouldn't he.
Exactly.
At the intellect and emotion.
That's right. I mean, to say in both cases. Both in the case of Abraham and the case of Bilam, there was a conflict. Abraham was told to kill his son. The Talmud talks about how he was going and that he was riding and was riding and the water was like getting up to his nose. But there was no water. You don't ride your donkey in water. And it really means to say that there was emotional conflict. And then there was another, the Gemara says, the Talmud says how Abraham's instincts were saying, what are you, a crazy old man that you've lost your senses, you're going to kill your son? Meaning to say that there was a part of him, of course, that did not want to kill his son. But he overcame that because it was his greater love for God. And I believe that's why it says over here that when he got up in the morning, when Bilam got up in the morning, so it says in Rashi, in 21, God said, you evil person, Abraham, our forefather, already preceded you. And it says that Abraham got up in the morning and he saddled his donkey. So you see there's a corollary being made between Bilam and between Abraham. Why is it, what's the corollary? Because in both cases there was tremendous conflict. And that's what it means, the two servants. Meaning there was a conflict that was between the emotions and intellect, what was true. So that's exactly what Bilam's conflict was over here. He knew that God favored the Jews. God said it. Because he says, Baruch, they're blessed. Ki Baruch. So he still wanted to curse them, though. Right, what God says? So he says, yeah, Baruch Hu, at the end of 12, it says God tells them that they're blessed. So this is really how I see the story unfolding. Really, there's the conflict that Bilam has. He wants to curse the Jews, yet he knows that God blessed them. That's what it means, the three times. Meaning, the three times means to say that he's trying to curse, and he can only curse through God, but he's trying to curse the people who God established a providence with. And the three times could either mean the providence that's expressed in God's the way he relates to the nation, the three holidays. You see how God on three different occasions had shown his providence and saved the Jews. But even more primary, you could say another area of the conflict that Bilam had was that Bilam knew the history of the Jews, and he knew that it was due to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that there was this relationship that was established. So that was the very core reason why there is a providence and a favoritism that God has for the Jew, due to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So when he was on his path trying to curse the Jews, he couldn't get that out of his mind, that it's because of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. These things were hitting him. That's why it was three times. It hit him three times on the path. So that's what it means, it turned aside three times. Now what does it mean that, since we understand that's what the three represents. It represents the cause of the conflict. He was trying to curse those who God favored. And he can only curse with God. right? But what is it that really perceives this reality and that he keeps on suppressing? It's the conscious. It's the person's conscious. So what's the conscience? The donkey. The conscience of the person is that which senses reality. All right, so it's the conscious. Are we still on?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, we're here.
Okay. So it's the conscience of the person that really sees reality. Like when you want to do something which is wrong, there's a part of you that senses that this is your morality. This is telling you that this is the wrong thing to do. And sometimes you'll just suppress it and you won't care. That's what the hitting of the donkey is. He keeps on hitting this thing, which is senses the reality. It sees the angel. The donkey alone sees the angel. But Bilam in this story represents his instinctual drive. And instincts don't perceive reality. That is not what they do. Just like the heart does not take in air, it pumps. And just like the lungs don't pump, but they take in air. And they oxygenate the blood. So also, the faculties of the mind have limited functions. So the function of the instincts is purely to push a person towards satisfaction. It does not perceive. It just, the mind takes in reality. There are different enjoyments that the body craves and learns. And then when the instincts push, they just push to do it. But instincts don't perceive. They don't have the ability for perception. That's what it means that Bilam didn't see the angel. He did not see reality. The angel of God means the truth, the reality over here. That they're favored, the Jews are favored. So that's why it says that only the donkey saw it, and Bilam didn't. Because it's the conscious which senses what's the right thing to do. So he doesn't want to deal with it, he keeps on hitting it. But what happens is as the conscious tries to emerge and deliver information to the person, it gets stronger and stronger. That's why Bilam had to use a bigger and bigger stick. That's why it says the last time he hit it with a stick, Ibn Ezra says, to show you that he had to keep on, he needed a greater amount of power to suppress what is his conscious was telling him. He just didn't want to face it. Eventually he does, and it's necessary for God to step in. That's what says God opened the mouth. It would not have happened by Bilam alone. So God interceded in order to reveal the information to him. So that's what it means that there was no astonishment when the donkey spoke, because it wasn't a real event. So that's what he talks back to it. Meaning to say that he's bothered by this and is finally confronted by the information. So therefore he, at that point, that's when he was able to see the angel. He was able to see the truth. But you see also, well, there are other particulars too, like why was his leg crushed against the wall? So that is, as we said last week, that when a person's energies are being thwarted and he's in conflict, there's a slowdown in terms of his energies, which is represented by limping, or that your leg is hurt. So the leg being crushed against the wall means that his ability to move towards his real goal was being slowed down. And it became more narrow and narrow as he was traveling, until there was no way around. There was no way to deny it anymore. And that's when he finally saw the truth.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Can we review verses 32 through 33? I really want to understand what's going on here.
Okay.
When it said the angel of Hashem said to him, for what reason did you strike your she-donkey these three times? And we've gone through that.
Right.
That said, behold, I went out to impede, for you hastened on the road to oppose me. So that's where Bilam kept doing that. But it said the she-donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. Is that because Bilam kept hitting it, and so the she-donkey did keep going? Because then it said that Hashem killed the donkey, and that if...
No, it doesn't say he killed it. It just says it's dead. It just says that had it not turned aside, so then Kiatog, even you, I would kill, and she I would have let live. So you could interpret that because it says also you I would have killed, implies that it did kill the donkey. You're right, you could say that. But what I believe that means, that the donkey died, it means to say that once the conscience gives the person the information, now it finally surfaces and you finally see what's bothering you. Now the function of the conscious doesn't exist anymore. It now did its job. It finally brought the conflict to his mind. So that's the way of saying that the donkey died, means that its job is over.
Oh, I see. I wondered if, you know, because bringing an animal to sacrifice, I wondered if it had to do with that, that the donkey was sacrificed instead of him, and now that he's truly repented and sees his sin.
Well, that would make sense here. We don't say that there's a replacement for the person. If they did something wrong, they have to own up to it. They have to address it. So there wouldn't be that type of an idea in the Torah that it was taken as, you know, like proxy in his place. I think what the idea that we're saying is that the fact that it is dead means that it has no more function anymore. Once it's finally delivered the information to Bilam, now he's got to work with that information and decide what he's going to do. But the donkey has no function anymore, as if it's dead.
Isn't the idea behind a sin offering, though, that that the animal dies, as in a sense that it would be you?
If he brought it, but there was no offering stated over here.
Okay. Rabbi, I am confused. Please forgive me. I need to ask a question. Are we saying now that there really was not a donkey the whole time? This was just his emotions?
Exactly. I mean, it could be that there was an event, too, in reality, where he was riding his donkey, traveling to Balak, the king of Moab. But the entire story here is not taking place physically. That doesn't discount, I mean,
okay.
Bilam is also in this story. But by the fact that we're saying the story is taking place in his mind, it doesn't discount that Bilam was a real physical person. So we're not discounting there was a real donkey. But there was no actual speech of a donkey. This was all a vision, a conflict that he was in. And everything really points to it. It's just beautiful how every part of the story is illustrating for us this whole conflict and all these details, and it really is just, it's amazing how the Torah goes out of the way, but you see that it did in a concealed manner. Because when you're dealing with, because you can ask a question, so why not tell me there was a conflict? Talk about it in open terms. That when a person has a conflict, so there's a part of him that does this, there's a part of him that does that. See, I believe the reason is, and this explains why the rabbis in general don't say things openly, is because they preserve true ideas for those people who can really see them. And if they would state it openly, so that there's a psyche and a person and there's different emotions and there's different parts to the mind, people might just dismiss it. When Freud once got up and gave a lecture, he said to his audience as an introductory statement that he says, I understand that in, you know, a person becoming a doctor, a physician, so you have a much easier time to, you know, the teacher has much easier time to convince his students of the reality of the different problems with the body, because you could point to an organ, you could point to a disease, you can show relationships physically. But Freud understood that now I'm talking about the psyche, and even if you open up the mind, you don't see the id, you don't see the ego, you don't see the conscious. So he recognized that he was confronted with problems as he was breaking new ground. The Torah also is not going to openly state certain things that could be easily dismissed, but it will keep them preserved. And the rabbis follow in that same suit, and they describe things as metaphors. And when a person's ready, they can see the true idea behind it. If a person's not ready, he should admit to himself, this is just a strange story and I don't know what it means. So here also, this is talking about and giving us insight into how we work in conflict. And you see there's a correlation. It gives you hints back to Abraham. He was on a donkey, and there were two servants with him. So in both cases, there was a human being that was confronted with conflict and was controlling something and was dealing with the issue and what the actual the phenomena that came up in the mind. And it gives us all this great detail, but it also gives us those two main hints that tell us this can't be physical. The Torah doesn't just leave us, you know, hopeless without giving us solid clues as to how to interpret something. It tells us openly that the donkey saw something and Bilam didn't. That forces us to say that this cannot be taking place physically. And that Bilam, like Doug, you pointed out very well. How could he just talk back to the donkey as if it's a friend of his, not even being astonished? He's not even taken back? But all the detail of the leg being crushed, and the three times, and that being repeated, and the donkey dying, and the hitting it with a stick, it just is, it's just robust with the information. It takes time to go through it to really analyze and see what the idea is. But once you finally see an opening, everything just falls into place.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I've read it several times, I must admit. I never saw it this way. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So it makes the whole thing, you know, it's like somebody opened the light. It's, I feel so ashamed, though, because I read it before.
Yeah, well, some stories are hard.
I never saw anything.
Yeah, some stories are more difficult than others.
Yeah, I suppose.
Rabbi,
yes, Doug?
Two questions. In our study of Proverbs, we've talked about the conscience and that you can't always rely on it to be accurate because there are people that, you know, their conscience makes them feel guilty over things that there's no rational reason to feel guilty over.
Yes.
So are we thinking about the conscience in this interpretation in a different way than that?
Well, yes, because here clearly the conscience is being presented with an angel of God, which is absolute truth. So here there's no question that what it's perceiving is accurate.
Okay. And then I guess my second question is, if we, at the very beginning, we raised the question of whether Bilam really had the capability to curse people, and apparently, as I understand it, Rabbi Chait said no, but that he, you know, he was good at timing and kind of watching things. So if that were true, why is it that he gets the vision or whatever the prophecy from Hashem, who's telling him, don't curse these people? And why is kind of the whole story going through this fairly elaborate exposition, not wanting him to curse these people, if in fact he really can't do it anyway?
That's a good question. I mean, he knows that he can't really do it, but perhaps in accordance with Rabbi Chait's explanation, he might be able to see something negative about the Jew, and he might be able to see how events are unfolding. If, for example, it says that it was his idea to send the Moabite women to seduce the men. So once they would start sinning, so then Bilam knew that they would be worthy of punishment, so that he could pronounce a curse at that point. So he knew that he could involve himself a certain way that would bring about negativity for the Jew. He knows he can't do it without God, but he also knows that a sinful Jew would have to be cursed. I mean, would have to be punished. So he could, and that's what he did later on. He advised, send these women in, let them seduce the Jews, let them get involved in illicit sexual relationships. And now he knew that they would have to be punished, so then he could pronounce a curse, and ostensibly he caused the punishment. So I say that's how it fits in. That he, you're right, I can't do it. He was clear about that, but still he hated the Jews, and he figured out some way, you know, how he could work this out.
Okay, thank you.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah. All right. So I think that covers all the questions, right? Were there any other questions?
I haven't looked at all the commentators or at the commentators on this particular part, but in verse 34, Bilam says, I have sinned. Do the commentators accept that he really has repented here?
It doesn't appear to be, because he still tries to curse them later.
Yeah.
And you see, he advised Balak later about the Moabite women.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions or comments?
I think I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, Rivka.
Very good.
No, I'm good also.
Good, okay. All right. So I guess we'll pick
Thank
up.
Thank you, Rabbi. It was very interesting.
Yeah, I thought you'd like it.
Yeah.
All right, so next week we'll get back
yeah,
to
you. Yeah, for me, this is superb. Again, I wanted to repeat. I've read this several times, and I never saw what I was reading. Never understood it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. So next week we'll pick up, I guess, where we left off with the Kahelas. We're in Chapter 3, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, everybody. Have a great week. And we'll continue. We'll continue then.
Thanks, Rabbi. You have a great week, too.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Have a good week.
Bye-bye.